This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we're going to be talking about Obama's new appointee to the Supreme Court, Elena Kagan. We'll be speaking with law professor Francis Boyle.
According to Boyle, the court will be moving to the right if Kagan is confirmed. Is that change we can believe in?
Law professor, vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and a lifelong litigator and advocate for women's rights, Rhonda Copeland, passed away in early May.
We talk with Kathy Albisa, a colleague of Rhonda, and we'll discuss some of Rhonda's major cases, her efforts to guarantee federal funding for abortion, and her efforts to enforce international human rights in the United States. Rhonda is sorely missed already.
Stay with us.
Michael, one of the significant achievements in the extension of civil liberties was the Miranda case, and now it's under attack by the chief law enforcement officer in the United States, Eric Holder, Obama's attorney general. What's going on?
Well, the Miranda case a number of years ago was established that the police or any interrogator had to give warnings to a person who's in custody or a detainee, anyone who they take into custody, and the warnings are that you have a right to a lawyer and that anything you say may be used against you, and if you want a lawyer, we'll provide you with a lawyer. And once those warnings are given, and if the person says, well, I don't want to talk, I want my lawyer, then that's the end of questioning. You can't question at all. Not the end. It's not even the beginning of questioning. So that's been a really a firm bedrock of the protection of the Fifth Amendment right in particular against self-incrimination. And we've never really thought that was in much jeopardy, although the right wing has gone after it constantly. They've gone after the Miranda rule. There's always been an exception called the public safety exception, which if there's an imminent need to question someone without the Miranda warnings for apparently a very short period, you can do that if, for example, you know, there's a kidnapping or there's some big explosive going to happen or something like that. And it came up in this recent Times Square case where they did not give the man who allegedly placed the car bomb a Miranda warning, but they questioned him very quickly under the public safety exception. So that's where it was until a few days ago, Michael.
Yeah, but the newspaper reports say that the Obama administration had been reconsidering the whole Miranda situation even before the Times Square guy.
That would be interesting to know if they really were or whether they're just making it up now or whether they're just getting attacked. But it's conceivable, as you and I just putting in context, have been a disaster on civil liberties, let's be honest. We have a preventive detention scheme essentially at Guantanamo, and they're continuing to hold people under preventive detention, no charges. We have military commissions, one operating right now against Omar Khadr, the kid who was picked up, the Canadian, at 15 years old. He's now 23, being tried. So you have military commissions, you have a preventive detention, you have Guantanamo still open. The changes in Miranda in the context of Obama's other real disappointments on civil liberties, you would never think that he would actually go farther than the Bush administration. I mean, many would not think that. Many would think he'd at least the worst he was going to do was remain the same, although most people thought he wasn't going to remain the same. But he's not even remaining the same. Eric Holder, after the Times Square incident came out, Eric Holder came out, our attorney general, and said he wants to expand the exception to Miranda. What that means is he wants to expand the public safety exception and essentially be able to question people for great lengths of time without giving them their Miranda warnings. And you understand, you could then use the evidence they give against them in court because it's an exception to Miranda. It doesn't foreclose the use of evidence. So here you have Eric Holder, who a few months ago swore up and down how much he loved Miranda and what a great rule it was and we didn't need to change it, all of a sudden saying, well, he's willing to examine whether we need to change Miranda. And then you have David Axelrod, the president's chief advisor. You have David Axelrod coming on CNN and saying, yes, he thinks we ought to re-examine Miranda as well. So here you have a bedrock of criminal rights defendants that and the Constitution that came out of the Warren courts of the 60s, and you have it now being undercut by the Obama administration. It's pretty shocking. And apparently that's not the only surprise we're going to get. So they're looking at expanding the exceptions to defendants' rights, in other words, expanding the exceptions to Miranda, And they're also looking at a second aspect, which is presentment. Now, most of our listeners may not know that word. It's a technical legal word. But within 24 hours of being detained, you have to be brought before a judge. And a judge has to advise you of your right to an attorney, of what's going to happen to you, and bail has to be set, whether you can be held or not under our bail system. It's obviously a key right. So the combination of Miranda and presentment are key criminal justice rights. In the same interview, or at least it's been now indicated that the Obama administration is now looking at whether or not they should hold people back from going to court within 24 hours. I wondered myself, the Times Square guy, there was no appearance in court. And I don't think there's been an appearance in court yet. Right. So I'm sitting here scratching my head. You know, you're a criminal defense attorney on occasion, Michael, and so have I been. And you know, if we don't get a person in front of a court in 24 hours, we bring a habeas corpus to get them in front of a court. We say there's a right to go to court. So I'm scratching my head. How come this guy hasn't been brought to court yet? What they said in the papers, at least, is that, well, they didn't give him his Miranda rights. He started talking. And then he said, well, you don't have to bring me to court. It's his decision, yes, but it's his decision when he has an attorney there giving him advice on what his decision ought to be. And he didn't obviously get an attorney at all. They just said to him, okay, you're talking, keep talking, and you don't want to go to court? Okay, that's fine. We won't take you to court. So the second exception they're thinking now, the second change they're thinking of, and it's a draconian change, would be to delay somehow in the law that you don't have to bring a person, you know, conceivably a person that fits within some kind of public safety exception, into a court. The whole thing is, it's a watering down of fundamental rights that we have thought, you and I certainly, since the 60s when we began thinking about law for 40 years.
It's easy to do it when you have a real bad guy who wants to blow people up in Times Square. But that's the problem, because that makes bad law. And somewhere down the line, it's very possible that you can have a situation in the United States like you have in Greece, where the government is trying to suppress the standard of living of most of the Greek people way, way down, and you have a rebellion of the Greek people. And if that happens in the United States, then it could happen. We don't know. But I think that they're fashioning these laws with one eye over their shoulder that it might happen, and then they'll use it against people not like who want to blow up things in Times Square, but against people who like to, you know, increase their wages at so-and-so hospital.
I think that's really critical.
Danger.
If you look at what happened at the Republican National Convention here, when they kept people away from court for more than 24 hours, and they kept them in the so-called Guantanamo in the Hudson, they essentially did that in an administrative way without claiming that they couldn't get the fingerprints fast enough. They had all kinds of BS reasons. But they could put this in, and they could say it's a public safety exception that we have to keep people off the streets because they're causing riots or raucous behavior, and therefore we don't have to take them to court. And we can just essentially keep them in prison for a period of time, and maybe it'll say a week in the statute, maybe it'll say 2 weeks. Whatever it says, in my view, it's completely illegal, and if they somehow find it's legal, it's certainly a draconian measure that leads to a police state.
Michael, there's some big news coming out of Spain with respect to the CIA.
Yes, you know, there's been three cases actually pending in Spain. Two have to do with U.S. torture, Guantanamo, and other issues like that. And one, the third, has to do with rendition. And that one's been very quiet for a long time. It's been going on for two or three years. It's actually a case concerning the kidnapping of people in various countries and those people then passing through Spain. And of course, Spain considers that, as does most of the world, an international crime to kidnap people. And they don't want their territory used for this purpose. That case had been very quiet. In fact, I was in Berlin and it barely came up. The other two cases, the Bush 6, the lawyers came up, as well as the Guantanamo torture, broader look at U.S. torture program came up. But there's a third case, and that's for rendition. And it concerns a number of people who were rendered, but particularly the German who was on a vacation bus, taken out of Macedonia off the bus, taken to Afghanistan and tortured. But the CIA agents apparently took him through Spain on the way, or themselves went to Spain on the way, and stopped in Palma. And in Palma, they gave fake names, a fake travel plans, and all this other stuff. In a shock, a real shock, there's a report. The headline goes, "Terrorism, Spain, rendition, CIA agents arrest demanded." I want to say that again. CIA agents arrest demanded. The prosecutor in Spain, which is called the Audiencia Nacional, has asked the judge in the case for the arrest of 13 CIA agents accused in alleged cases of rendition. That is to say, the kidnapping of individuals and their transfer by plane carried out against foreign citizens, and it reported that included in those was the El Masri case. The plane made a stop, apparently, at the Spanish airport at Palma, and then it goes ahead and names the 13 agents. I don't know if they're the real names or the fake names, but names the 13 agents. I think they may be the real names. It names the agents who were involved in the kidnapping. And I think it names the real names because the agents, in their complete ineptitude, registered at the hotel or some hotel under their real names, ordered drinks, you know, videotapes, etc., to watch at night. They may have even been porn. We don't know. And so I think they know the real names. And now they've asked for their arrest. And that's interesting because what it means is not only are they going to be subject to arrest in Spain, but subject to arrest certainly in all of what's called the Schengen countries, which is the EU plus Eastern European countries. And conceivably, they've actually issued international arrest warrants with Interpol. So if these agents are picked up, these agents go through any customs at almost any country in the world, they can wind up in a jail in Spain. Well, guys, it looks like at least in Spain, you don't get the Congressional Medal of Honor for being a CIA agent.
Today, we discuss Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan's background with Professor Francis Boyle, who teaches law at the University of Illinois. Boyle is the author of Tackling America's Toughest Questions. In his article titled Supreme Court Pick, Kagan Loves the Federalist Society, Boyle notes Kagan explicitly endorsed the Bush administration's bogus category of enemy combatant, whose implementation has been a war crime in its own right. He also writes that Kagan has actually said, "I love the Federalist Society." Almost all of the Bush administration lawyers responsible for the war and torture memos are members of the Federalist Society.
So let's start with this question. We're talking to Francis Boyle. Who do you think is going to make a more liberal justice, Elena Kagan or Sonia Sotomayor?
I really think, and you're fully aware of what she has done in United States federal courts at all levels, that basically she has fully defended all the Bush administration's hideous atrocities on civil rights, civil liberties, human rights, and international law.
We're talking about Elena Kagan now, right.
Elena Kagan. There has been no retreat, no abandonment of any of the Bush positions. Even the Ninth Circuit, as you know, was amazed. She's fully carrying out the Bush policies in the United States federal courts. And you'll note she's supposed to be replacing Justice Stevens, no great liberal there, but at least Stevens on the cases that counted, Razul Bumyadin Hamdan, came through for the American Republic and our Constitution.
Francis, talk about why those three cases counted, what they stood for.
Well, gosh, I mean, the writ of habeas corpus, which really separates our country from a police state and a dictatorship, was at stake at two of them. And the last one, Bumyadin, as you know, was a 5-4 decision. Fortunately, Stevens was able to win over Justice Kennedy to grant cert and then to rule in favor of habeas corpus. Kagan would have been on the other side. And Bumyadin, that was a near-death experience for our Constitution. If they had ruled the other way, I shudder to think where we'd all be today without the writ of habeas corpus. On the Hamdan decision, striking down the kangaroo courts on Guantanamo for violating the Geneva Conventions and the Uniform Code of Military Justice. And there, even Justice Kennedy pointed out in his separate opinion that violating the Geneva Conventions also violated the U.S. War Crimes Act of 1996 and thus was a war crime. Well, again, we would have lost all those cases under Kagan, given the position that she has taken. She did write this one tendentious tome in the Harvard Law Review. I haven't gone through it all, but I did read the abstract. And it's basically the equivalent of the Federalist Society unitary executive power theory of the presidency that really goes back to Thomas Hobbes and the Leviathan and the blueprint for a totalitarian state. So in my perspective, she'd be a total disaster on the cases that really count for the future of our Constitution, the Bill of Rights, human rights, international law.
Frances Boyle, what do you say to those liberals who argue that she's the best we're going to get?
I don't believe so at all. She's not liberal at all. I mean, basically, she's a neoconservative. She has literally no qualifications to speak of, except that she was dean of Harvard Law School. And the only reason she was made dean of Harvard Law School was that the neoconservative president of Harvard, Larry Summers, made her the dean to carry out his neoconservative agenda at Harvard Law School. She promptly announced that of a $400 million capital campaign, she was going to allocate $20 million to promoting Summers' globalization at Harvard Law School, immediately proceeded to hire large numbers of conservative and neoconservative white faculty toward that end, only hired one professor of color.
Those figures are astounding. First, in terms of race, what she did was basically, you know, make the place whiter than it already was. And then, as you've pointed out and others have, she hired Jack Goldsmith, who was one of the authors of a number of the torture memos.
And not just the torture memo. As I'm sure Michael can tell you, Goldsmith helped set up the kangaroo court system down in Guantanamo. He authored torture memos. And then, in addition, he authored another memo that authorized, in his capacity as legal counsel, the kidnapping of people from Iraq and then their transportation to another country where they would be tortured in violation of the Geneva Conventions and the Convention Against Torture, which are war crimes. Now, I made sure that Kagan and the rest of the Harvard faculty knew that Goldsmith was up to his nose in torture, war crimes, and forced disappearances and crimes against humanity, and they hired him anyway because that was what Kagan was instructed to do, pretty much, to carry out the neocon agenda of Larry Summers, who supported the Bush war on terrorism. And so she and Kagan wanted to hire one of the architects of the Bush war on terrorism, which Michael Ratner and the Center for Constitutional Rights has done such a heroic effort to oppose in United States federal courts for the last 9 years. And we're still fighting against Kagan supporting the Bush war on terrorism in all its essential accoutrements.
Frances, let me step back and ask you a more fundamental question, or really ask you what your views are on this. Justice Stevens has said that perhaps the only exception being Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the court has gotten more and more reactionary over the last 40 years, with each successive judge being further to the right than the last one that was appointed. Obviously, you think that that would be true of Kagan as well, and I agree with you. But my question is this: what process do you see is underlying all of this? Why has there been that right-wing drift for four decades? You know, what's going on here in terms of what forces are shaping the Supreme Court?
Right. Well, there's a new book out by a professor at Princeton University Press that I think documents the deliberate effort by all the right-wing funders and think tanks to move the United States judiciary and American legal education to the extreme right. And it goes back certainly to the founding of the Federalist Society by Mies and Bork and some of the others. You probably remember the Heritage Foundation report put together as before the Reagan administration came to power.
Called Mandate for Change. I remember
right.
It well, Frances.
Right. And all this was funded and orchestrated and bought and paid for by all these right-wing funders. So this has been done deliberately and on purpose, starting with the Reagan administration coming to power. Now, the main problem with this book by this professor that just published it at Princeton on the conservative legal movement is that, you know, he bought all the Kool-Aid on the Federalist Society that somehow you know, they're a balanced, reasonable organization. We know for a fact the Federalist Society is in favor of overturning Brown versus the Board of Education. We had one of these guys out here. I cross-examined him. He was also against Shelley v. Kramer, where the Supreme Court struck down racist covenants on land against black people.
Yeah, Rehnquist had one of those on his house in Shorewood, where I come from.
That's right. And these people want to go back to the good old days of the Herbert Hoover Supreme Court. Now, Kagan, as recently as December 22, 2009, in her capacity as U.S. Solicitor General for Obama, publicly stated on National Public Radio, quote, "I love the Federalist Society," unquote. And what we're seeing is Kagan carrying out right now in her capacity as Solicitor General the policies of the Federalist Society. It was Federalist Society lawyers who also were behind the entire Bush Jr. torture scandal.
One thing I don't get about any of this, Francis, you know, Bush appointed both Alito and Roberts, you know, who are, I don't know how to say this, right of the Attila the Hun or something, whatever. But, you know, the vote on Roberts was 42 Democrats voted against him. So they could have filibustered it if they wanted. And it was obvious that he was going to be just awful. I mean, completely awful. And now you have a situation with Obama, and he's appointing someone who, you know, at best is completely mediocre and is, you know, not going to be a liberal judge on that court. And it's unclear to me why the Democrats can't, they just chicken out. They won't put someone in there. They won't even, you know, the three nominees that were looked at, Diane Woods from your home state, Chicago, Illinois, and then, of course, Garland, who's more conservative. But they wouldn't even put Diane Woods forward, who was at least a little more liberal, I think, than Kagan.
You know, I'm licensed in the Seventh Circuit, though I haven't appeared before. I think, you know, certainly the best we could have hoped for was Harold Coe.
Well, that would have been amazing.
Right. And yet Coe was, according to the New York Times, was never under serious consideration. And the reason is, of course, Harold, as dean of the Yale Law School, did everything humanly possible to oppose the Bush atrocities against the Constitution, Bill of Rights, human rights, and international law. So Obama and his people there know full well that Kagan is going to be the spear carrier for presidential powers on the Supreme Court, unlike Stevens, and is going to tip that balance now precariously 5-4, as we saw in Boumediene. And remember, in Boumediene, originally, they denied cert because Stevens didn't think he had the five votes.
Yeah, let's go through the count for our listeners. On the really conservative side, you have Scalia, you have Roberts, you have Alito. Those are three.
And Thomas,
four. So you have four votes.
Well, you know what the joke is, that Scalia's got two votes.
Okay, so you basically have four votes that you're dead in the water on, no matter what. Anything positive you want to do, any pullback on presidential power, basically, they're rubber stamps completely. So, and then you had Kennedy sort of in the middle, swinging both ways. And they had the so-called, you know, for your and my younger days, they wouldn't be called a liberal bloc. They would be called a moderate bloc, maybe. So you had four of the moderate bloc with Kennedy in the middle. And now what you've done is you have the four goners. You still have Kennedy sitting out there, you know, good and bad, depending on. And then you took one of the four so-called moderates, Stevens, and you're replacing that moderate with Kagan. What really is going on here is you've said in some of your writings, the court will actually be moving more toward the right. Is that correct?
I think that's correct. I'm afraid to say so. It's going to be moving. You're going to give the four conservatives a majority on large numbers of issues, especially presidential power, which, as you know, is extremely dangerous. I mean, we're tottering on a police state here. You know, Noam Chomsky compared the situation to the Weimar Republic. Well, I don't think, you know, this is the United States of America. We're not the Weimar Republic.
Republic was much more democratic than this state.
All right, but we have a longer tradition than that. This is a very dangerous time for the future of our republic and our Constitution, and I'm afraid Kagan will be lethal with respect to that.
On one issue right now, Francis, that I want to ask you about, we mentioned on the show earlier that they're considering cutting back on Miranda, the public exception, and Holder's saying that, and of course that's going to be legislative but also presidential power, and it would look to me, would you say Kagan would uphold that or not?
I believe she's taken the position that if Congress were to ratify this, she'd go along with it. Not this precise issue, but
right.
She's apparently taken the position before in the Youngstown case, as you know, that when you have the president and Congress working together, then that's pretty much it. But as we know, Stevens ruled against that position in Boumediene, and they struck down the Military Commissions Act, despite the rationale there in the Youngstown case, finding that it was an unconstitutional suspension of the writ of habeas corpus. Weren't you involved in that, Mike?
Yes. Yeah. You're correct, though, but that's a good point.
Right.
That even though they had Congress and the president together, Stevens was willing to strike it down. And you can bet from what you've said that she's so weak on presidential power, or believes presidential power should be so strong or unfettered, that when they come together like that, you know, we're going to get killed on this stuff.
I'm afraid you're right. Yeah, that's the way I see it. Plus, the statement by President Obama that she cares for the common people, I mean, she's an elitist snob. You know, she went to, Hunter and Princeton and Oxford and Harvard, and there she is promoting globalization at Harvard Law School, hiring people to come in and teach global loaning. Just to lick the boots of Larry Summers, Mr. Globaloney himself, with Bob Rubin under Clinton, in part responsible for the economic disaster we see today. And then we find out that while she was dean at Harvard Law School, she was moonlighting on the Goldman Sachs payroll.
I'm glad you brought that up, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah, for many years, yeah.
That was in the Wall Street Journal on Friday.
Yeah.
And, of course, Larry Summers helped bail out Goldman Sachs there at the White House. So, you know, this is all incredibly incestuous, pro-corporate, my opinion, pro-totalitarian things that are going on here. She's not for the common people, that's for sure. Where's the evidence of any of that?
That's what some of the liberals are wringing their hands about, that she doesn't have that clear of a record, that she actually has not much of a record at all. She was never a judge. She hasn't written that much. We shouldn't buy a pig in a poke argument. That's one of the arguments they make.
I think you have to understand so many of these talking head legal experts you see on TV and in the news media are affiliated with the Democratic Party. I'm a political independent. I always have been, and I try to call them as I see them. So, of course, they get up there, and they're supporting her. I notice even Alliance for Justice just came out in her favor. I mean, that's appalling.
Been and, upset with Alliance for Justice. So just say, everyone note, they're friends of ours and all that, and I think the center may be part of the broad coalition. But, you know, they were part of the people who, you know, were never willing to take on Roberts initially.
Right.
They eventually may have come around, but they said, well, we want the next guy may be worse. Was it Roberts was first, right?
And then we get Alito.
And then we got Alito. And
just as bad.
Yeah, I mean,
you got Scalia and Thomas, who are both members of Opus Dei, the far, far right organization founded with the encouragement and support of Franco in Spain in the mid-30s. Talk about authoritarian status. This is what really defines it. And you've got those two guys anchoring the far right wing of the court.
Well, we appreciate this, Francis. And unfortunately, we're just seeing such a strong trend now in the country. I mean, both on the court.
What's really disappointing is to see Obama making these decisions. You know, unlike Bush, who wasn't a lawyer, you know, Obama taught constitutional law at the University of Chicago Law School. He should know better.
Right? He may or should or whatever, but... You know, the only reason I'm not disappointed is I now expect it from him. We saw what happened with Miranda. We saw preventive detention. We saw what happened with military commissions. You know, it's like a long train at this point. You know, now he's adding some cabooses. What can I say?
That's an irrelevant quality, whether he's sincere or not. He's doing it. He's doing it to us. And he's using that mantle of popularity, particularly amongst black people. The latest polls are 86%. It's that section of the population that was always the spearhead for the most progressive things in this country. And they're quiescent now because Obama's the president. And that's one of the reasons we're in so much trouble.
With Kagan, you know, they're touting all her skills about building a coalition at Harvard Law School. Well, the coalition she built excluded professors of color. That's what happened. She hired one professor of color out of 32 hires. I mean, it's appalling.
Amazing. That is appalling.
And so what do you think is going to happen here in the future? And especially, as I said, the agenda of the Federalist Society judges, at some point is to go after Brown versus the Board of Education, and you saw that in the Louisville case and elsewhere. They're just waiting for an opportunity.
Michael and I want to thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and we'd like to have you back hopefully very soon. Thank you, Francis.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thanks,
and,
Francis.
Michael, hang in there.
Okay.
You're really following there in the tradition of Len Weinglass and Bill Kunstler, who did the Chicago 8-7 trial when I was an undergrad there at the University of Chicago, and after I had been at the festivities in Chicago.
Well, so, great. Thank you, Francis.
You're
we always love
tradition, Michael.
We love your articulateness on these issues, but thank you, Francis.
All right. Well, bye-bye. I mean it, Michael. Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Law and Disorder. If you like this kind of old folk music, check out Down Home Radio at downhomeradioshow.com.
In early May, we lost one of our best progressive lawyers, Rhonda Copeland. Rhonda worked at the Center for Constitutional Rights, eventually established and then taught for many years at CUNY Law School at the International Human Rights Women's Law Clinic. She brought some of the more significant human rights cases, including the Philartica case, which established that you could sue for international human rights violations in the United States. And she tried to win the case holding the Hyde Amendment, which banned federal funding for abortion. She tried to hold that Hyde Amendment unconstitutional, but lost that case in the Supreme Court 5-4. She was a vice president and on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights. We talk now with Kathy Albisa, who is also on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights, actually vice chair of the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights, is the executive director of the National Economic and Social Rights Initiative, and is taking over some part of Rhonda's teaching position at CUNY Law School.
Welcome, Attorney Kathy Albisa, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael.
Kathy, you were close with Rhonda Copeland. You worked with her at the Center for Constitutional Rights, and you're actually taking over some of her work at CUNY Law School. Tell us about when you first met Rhonda.
Yeah, I actually worked with Rhonda at CUNY, at the International Women's Human Rights Law Clinic, although we both co-counseled with the center on a couple of cases. I actually met Rhonda on a car ride. It was a 25-hour car ride, in fact.
Oh, so you got to know her.
Yes, I got to know her really. It was really quickly. She needed to help driving a car down to Florida, and I needed to get down there. And we spent 25 hours talking about human rights in the United States. She had asked me why I had left constitutional litigation, and I shared all my frustrations with the limitations of the rights framework, how defensive the strategies were, and that I didn't know where to go next. And she said, I know where you should go next. And there she started to plot out the rest of my life.
Were you already the head of NESRI then? I mean, had NESRI been set up?
No. I would say Rhonda had a huge influence on NESRI.
NESRI being
creation,
the
National Economic and Social Rights Initiative. I mean, there are many people who've influenced us, but two sort of towering kind of intellectual contributors, if you want to call it that, were Rhonda Copeland and Paul Farmer, who brought a very, you know, together brought a very special vision to our work.
How many years ago was that, first of all?
This was 1993 or 4.
Did she lament about the loss on the abortion case?
Rhonda never stopped lamenting Harris v. McRae. But it wasn't just...
Harris v. McRae is the case that tried to hold unconstitutional the Hyde Amendment, which banned federal funding for abortion.
She was outraged that poor women would be treated differently than other women and that the court would allow having the status of poverty as a way of denying rights. And she didn't just lament. She was still furious and outraged.
No, she never gave up on that. And, you know, she, when I really, and I think I mentioned it to you, Kathy, when I read some of what she'd said about it, and I only got it in my mind after I read it again, because you always think, well, why should the federal government have to fund mm-hmm. poor women's abortions? But Rhonda said, look at it this way. It's actually a woman gets pregnant and she has a choice. She has a choice of either to go take that baby to term and have the baby or have the abortion. If she takes the baby to term and you're a poor woman, they'll pay for it. They'll pay for your health care. They'll go through it. You'll get it done. You can. You're not prohibited from getting it from a state government. But if you want to make the other choice to have an abortion, they won't pay for that. So essentially, the federal government is choosing the option of essentially forcing women to have babies if they can't afford to have abortions.
And the other assumption that's deeply embedded in that case and that's really problematic is that the court, in essence, was saying, we're not responsible as a society. It's not our problem, the poverty of this woman. It was basically individualizing her poverty, saying, well, if she wants an abortion and she can't get it because of poverty, it's her fault and her problem. And that's an assumption that is relevant to many, many issues beyond abortion.
And the case was only lost 5-4,
right?
Which is amazing when you think about it. It was 1980, right? Mm-hmm. And you think about it today, it was considered shocking that the federal government would take away the right to have abortions paid for.
Yeah.
But today, I think you wouldn't get 5-4. You'd probably just get killed in the court on this case.
Well, and we've been killed on that for years.
But that was one of the great things you're saying about Rhonda. She never let go.
Even
when I heard her a couple of weeks ago, when she set up the Copeland Fund for Gender Justice at the center, she was still going on about the losses of the key cases that she brought.
She was still working on McRae to the day she died. And she, in a sense, will always be working on it through this fund. This fund is very important, the Copeland Fund for Gender Justice.
Why don't you tell us what that is?
Rhonda and I had many hours of conversation about this fund. She thought it was critical that a progressive gender perspective be embedded into some body of work, and she thought the Center for Constitutional Rights was the perfect place for it, that really looked at all these gender issues in a cross-cutting way, in a broad way, that understood the relevance of poverty, the relevance of race, the relevance of, you know, what they call sexual minorities, but Rhonda called sexual dissidents. She wanted a much more sophisticated, much more political body of gender legal work out there, and she thought that this fund could represent that, and it would make the work she'd done over decades and decades more meaningful and more sustainable.
And she set up that fund to start it off with her own life savings.
Rhonda Copeland was not a wealthy woman, but she, you know, she always was an activist. She was middle class because she was a law professor, and she was actually, her friends joked about how cheap she was. So she did save, you know, she saved what she had. And I said she wasn't a wealthy woman because I want people to understand what this gift meant. She gave $1 million for this fund, and that was everything. That was everything. That was her whole pension, her properties, everything over a lifetime.
Right. Amazing. No, it was a remarkable testament to her belief in the importance of gender work and her belief that the center could be able to carry it out. Can you talk a little bit about, because you know Rhonda, knew Rhonda so well, about what her thoughts were about? I mean, part of it was to integrate it in other work. Part was to take it on its own. But
right. Rhonda could never just check off one box. Let's just put it that way. When you'd say to her, Rhonda, well, do you want to have one staff person doing gender work? Do you want it, or do you want it mainstreamed into other parts of the center's work and other parts of the field? And she'd look at me in this exasperated way, like saying, why are you limiting yourself? It needs to be both. It needs to be part of the broader work of not just the center, but all progressive organizations. There should be a race perspective, a class perspective, a gender perspective in all the work. But it also needs to stand on its own in order to really get depth. So she never wanted to trade off breadth for depth in any context. She wanted both.
You know, when you were talking about her setting up the fund, Kathy, I remember that really, really poignant moment at the luncheon that the center held for her. It was kind of a goodbye luncheon because she passed away just several weeks afterwards.
10 days afterwards?
Yeah. That was a really, she didn't, no one wants to die, but Rhonda, being particularly stubborn, really didn't want to die. And it wasn't until that day at that luncheon where her community of what she called her lefty lawyer community and other activists came together to pay tribute to her, to say goodbye, and to, in a sense, commit to her to keep her legacy going.
And she responded to that.
Yes, that she reached closure. It was personally important.
Wow.
It was politically important. She wasn't ready to die till after that day. Mm.
And she said when she set up the fund and there was so much support for keeping her work going, she said, this makes it easier for me to die.
That's right. And you could see a huge shift in her afterwards. And you have to think about how committed a person is, that even at the moment of death, what they care most about is that the work they've done to protect rights of people all over the world gets carried on.
I sat there in complete, I mean, obviously completely moved by Rhonda, and her, you know, talk was so amazing. But I mean, here she was dying. She knew she probably didn't have very long to live. And she really wanted to talk about the work and what it meant to her and setting up the fund and how important it was. I mean, I think to myself, I would want to be anywhere but right there in front of 200 people, you know, doing what she did a few days, you know, really literally a few days before she
died. It was
physically
hard. She was in a lot of pain by then.
She couldn't really eat then? No.
She couldn't eat.
She hadn't eaten for weeks because she couldn't really eat anymore because of the cancer. Mm-hmm. But her will was just completely undiminished, as it always was. And this was that important to her, that she literally dragged herself there with her tubes, as you all saw.
Talk to us about the other famous case that she's associated with.
Well, the case that she always says saved my life was Filarctica v. Peña, because just as Harris v. McRae came down, which was devastating, lost to Rhonda, never got over it.
Right, Harris is the no state funding, is that?
No Medicaid funding.
No Medicaid funding.
Why don't we settle for that description,
let's settle
Michael?
Settle for that. No Medicaid funding for abortion. It's part of a state, part of that, but that's right.
Well, she had litigated Filarctica with her dear friend Peter Weiss at the center, and they were trying to hold a torturer accountable for torture committed outside of the United States, and using a very old statute called the Alien Tort Claims Act that said that an alien, meaning a non-citizen, could sue in U.S. courts for a tort in international law. It was a very creative and unique use of the statute, but when you kind of read it element by element, it fit. And when they won that case, when the court in a sense said a human rights violation anywhere is relevant everywhere, a whole new world of possibilities opened up for Rhonda. She was always a globalist. She was always a universalist. But when she saw that this tool of international law could be powerful here in one of the most exceptionalist countries in the world, one of the most resistant countries to international law, she got very excited and really dedicated the rest of her life to strengthening that tool.
It's interesting. I mean, what she said in the interview that we did with her was that both cases came down on the same day. Mm-hmm. She lost Harris v. McRae in the morning at the Supreme Court on the abortion funding. In the afternoon, she gets a call from the clerk basically saying that her and Peter had won, the center had won the Filarctica case. And that's what really pushed her into exactly what you're saying.
Right.
She said, well, look, here I lost on this constitutional stuff, and maybe we're going to have more success if we use international human rights as a way of protecting people's rights.
There's a saying in Spanish that if you translate it, it says, if they close the door, go out the window. And that is, in fact, what she did. It wasn't what it was meant for, but she got out.
And tell us a little more about what she did at CUNY and what the clinic does, because she actually set that clinic up, right?
Mm-hmm. She said she founded that clinic.
The clinic is called?
The International Women's Human Rights Law Clinic. And what she did with that clinic, in many ways, was challenge the traditional model of human rights work coming out of the United States. You know, the traditional model of human rights work in the United States is a northern NGO goes to a southern country, observes violations, claims to be objective, documents them, comes back and uses, in a sense, the global power imbalance to put pressure on that southern government through the northern government. She rejected that model. She basically founded the clinic on a model of solidarity, of working with women's organizations around the world in partnership closely. She never was part of a coalition that didn't have women from the global south as speaking for themselves, not being spoken on behalf of. She made no claims to being objective. She was on the side of victims. She was on the side of people whose rights were being violated. And she was on the side of people who held similar politics to her own. So it was a very different model of human rights. And it changed international law, because the other thing that she was very adamant about was, how would she put it? Don't disregard the banal, the ordinary things that actually represent very deep violations. So she convinced an entire international law system, along with her sisters in the effort, that domestic violence could in fact be a form of torture. That rape was not collateral damage in war, but was a war crime.
Yeah, and that was key, actually. That whole series of, not just cases, but briefs, working with other women's groups, particularly around the world, to convince international judges and lawyers that rape was a form of torture, and that then moving into domestic violence could be a form of torture, was absolutely critical to the human rights movement. There's no one really who denies, certainly the first part of it yet, that, that rape can be a form of torture, or rape is a form of torture. The second one I don't know as much about, but you can talk to, you can mention it. But.
Well, what's also interesting is the way Rhonda went about things, because she merged sort of intellectual capital with a kind of strategic ferocity and personal goodwill and relationship building. And these together made her very formidable. So when she was trying to convince the tribunals, the Rwanda Tribunal and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights that was looking at rapes in Haiti, that rape, in fact, was, you know, a form of torture and a war crime. She not only had sort of built up this really incredible and compelling analysis, she had also built relationships across the world on this. But then she was strategically crafty. She would call up the Rwanda folks and say, you better make your decision quickly because the Inter-American Commission's about to get out ahead of you and you want to be the first. And then she would call the commission and tell them the same thing.
I didn't know that.
And these are the kinds of things, sort of understanding the way people work.
She was a worker like I've never seen. I mean, I used to litigate a little bit with her at the center, but I couldn't keep up. I mean, I would want to go home at 2 or 3 in the morning, and she would, till the last minute, would be correcting, thinking about strategically how to do this, what arguments to make, what ones we didn't make. And she was not about to reject an argument because some people thought it was silly or absurd. I mean, she mounted to make the arguments that she felt were necessary to make.
I would have constant arguments with her. We were writing an amicus brief when they were looking at the constitutionality at the Supreme Court level at the Violence Against Women Act. And she's looking at customary law, and she's looking at U.S. law and these domestic implementation issues. Very complicated. We decided I would do treaties, she would do customary law, because we're having too many arguments doing it together. And she comes to me with her argument. I said, Rhonda, the law doesn't support this. She's like, I don't care. The law is wrong. The law needs to support this. And this was always her approach. And yes, you're right. She never, ever stopped. And one day we were late filing. I think it was this very amicus brief. I said, Rhonda, the Supreme Court's not going to take an amicus brief. You just can't show up. We have to stop. We have to print it. We have to send it for production. We have to stop or it's going to get in late. She's like, no, I have to fix this and I have to fix that footnote and this argument needs to be stronger. Well, we were late. I thought they'd never take the brief. She got on a plane at 5 o'clock in the morning, 5:30, whatever the first plane out to D.C., knocked on the clerk's door and convinced them, personally convinced them, to take the brief.
Amazing. Yeah, that's just typical. There's a reason I couldn't keep up with her. You know, Rhonda and I started the same year, 1971, at the center. And Rhonda used to talk a lot about where women's rights were then, particularly the right to abortion. And, of course, the center was, through Nancy Stearns, was beginning some litigation on abortion. No one else in the country really was, or very few other people were. And it had always been looked at until the center, and then Rhonda and others, looked at it as a doctor's right to perform abortion. It was believed by the litigators that that was an easier way to go, doctors giving advice, doctors doing what they're supposed to do, than to go as if a woman had a right to choose an abortion. And the center and Nancy and Rhonda and others really pushed
the position that it was really a woman's right. And from then, Rhonda really just, I mean, just took off on issues of gender and women. And as well as other things, Rhonda always said, you know, I never wanted to be known as just a gender litigator or a women's rights litigator. That's why we talk about Philartica. That's why when she looks at the center now and she sees people are like a little bit of, are siloed a little bit into areas, she used to get very upset. She said, I don't like people being in silos. They should go from one place to another.
Right. She thought it was very important that people understand that they're part of a broad social justice and human rights movement, that we're not about our own issues, that we're about the broader agenda, that we're about the broader movement. And she never stopped seeing those connections. And that's what I mean by she approached her work from this perspective of solidarity, not just from her own particular project or her own particular community.
We're now going to play a short excerpt from an interview we did with Rhonda Copeland from our series, Lawyers You'll Like.
Historically, based on race and class, women have been differently treated in terms of their reproductive rights. So when the original anti-abortion laws started to come into the law in the United States, what was it about? It was about primarily wanting to be sure that the WASP population, the white population of the U.S., would not be out-reproduced by the immigrant population, and the way to do that was to cut back on abortion. It also had reasons to, like, eliminate the lay healers who did the abortions. Right. The anti-abortion law was to, the original purposes were to increase reproduction among the elite.
I didn't realize
right?
this at all.
It was also to get rid of those women lay healers who were really taking care of me. Abortion was a very central part of the healers' work. And because of that, they also became, in a sense, the doctors for women, right? And the doctors made themselves professional. They were working to become professional in the mid-19th century, and they had to get rid of this. So if you took away abortion, if you made that criminal, then you took away this very significant connection between women needing medical care and who was providing it. There was a little bit of human life stuff then, but it wasn't significant, and the church didn't think it was significant until 1875, the Catholic Church. So the point is that even our original abortion laws were class-based. Right. And then you come into other periods with the early 20th century and you have class-based eugenic laws. Right. You have Buck v. Bell and you have the class-based sterilization laws, which said, you know, you sterilize those who are socially inappropriate. Right. And that was a very broad category. That was then the fact that that was still going on in the 70s was rediscovered when it was realized that poor women were being told, who are on welfare, were being told that they would lose their welfare if they bore another child. There were the two young black girls who were put in the who hid in the closet to avoid being sterilized. So you had all of these things that were sort of at that point directed at poor people so that they wouldn't. Right. So then along comes abortion as a right, with at which time. Oh, and I might say that the class thing continued with regard to sterilization because you couldn't get a legal sterilization in most parts of this country before Roe v. Wade if you didn't meet the rule of 120. And the rule of 120 meant that your age times your number of children had to be 120.
That was Rhonda Copeland from our series Lawyers You'll Like. Rhonda was 65 when she died in 2010. So I guess that puts her back in the generation of people who were radicalized in the 60s and the early 70s. Did she ever talk to you about those early days?
Well, we talk a lot about just the differences in the political experiences we had growing up, because I was in high school under Reagan. And let's just say it was different.
Yeah.
And we would have a lot of conversations about, in a sense, what a challenge it was for a generation like
yeah.
mine to do activism and really be able to imagine this kind of radical success that the previous generation had, and how it very much stymied us and stymied our imagination. And she was a consummate mentor. It's why she became a professor. She wanted to build a new generation of leaders. And one of the things she wanted, the gift she wanted to give to people like myself, to all her students, was this gift of imagination, of really being able to see what success can look like before you get there, and never giving up on that goal because it because you could truly visualize it. And that's something our generation has.
No, it's true. I mean, when you mentioned that you're a high school student under Reagan, which was 1981 when the Mandate for Change was issued by Heritage and all of that Central America wars began. And that was essentially the end for people like Rand and me of a period of, you know, been lawyers for 10 years then, of amazing victories, of amazing ability to, you know, social movements. And Rhonda, when she talked about her past, you know, she said, look, I went to law school. I was from a middle or upper middle class family, I guess. And I didn't have that much thinking politically. I clerked for a federal judge. And then I did something, she said, that point. She was already upset by what was going on. And the judge she clerked for was one of the judges on a court that was about to hold unconstitutional certain restrictions. I mean, no funding of abortion. So she was conscious of that. But then she said, when I applied to the center, it was a very radical organization. But I decided to push myself and do something that was outside of my normal experience, which, of course, knowing Rhonda at all, one would know that that's what she would do.
Actually, she talked a lot about that as well. She always said that had she not gone to the center, she would have had a completely different life, that it transformed her, that that environment transformed her, that she could have gone to any of the more traditional mainstream organizations, and she genuinely felt that she would not have done the work she did, that she would not have done path-breaking work, that it was critical at that time to have a community that supported that kind of thinking, that supported taking chances, that it wasn't so much about winning specific cases, but winning for the movement.
So I know, Kathy, there's going to be a memorial for Rhonda coming up. When is that?
That's on the 21st of this month at 11:45 a.m. at Riverside, I think, Memorial
Chapel. It's on the Upper West Side in the 70s.
Upper West Side. This is a memorial, and then in September there'll be another event that you'll get more information about as it gets planned. On the 21st, we will be mourning her death together because it's a big loss for us all. But in September, we really want to celebrate her life and her legacy. So I do hope people will come out for both.
She was one of the greats, and we really miss her. And her legacy, I'm pleased, obviously, that you're going to be taking on some of her work. And that's just, you know, amazing to me, as well as the gender fund at the center. So, I mean, we have to live up to that, and that's not going to be easy.
And there'll need to be lots of us because it takes right. a village to keep this legacy.
And I just hear Rhonda, like, oh, you know, I can just see even when we're doing that work or our board meeting just pulling at us to push us forward or kick us going ahead on this stuff. And I think that's important. I think people will respect that a lot because it's not like you can feel like she's ever let go of you.
No, and I don't think we'll ever stop learning from what she brought to us.
Well, thank you, Kathy.
Yeah, thank you, Kathy, for talking about Rhonda Copeland and being with us on Law and Disorder.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.